This is SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.
This episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit is brought to you by Bluehost. You can now start your own blog or website in minutes for the very low price of just $6.95 per month. And Bluehost makes it really easy. That's why I recommend it. One-click installation of your WordPress blog, you get your own .com domain name included in the price, and never do you have to worry about bandwidth. Go to sqpn.com/bluehost for more information. And by the Amazon store. Click on the link on our website before you shop at Amazon, and your purchase will help support our show.
SQPN.com presents The Secrets of the Hobbit.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. Now, where to begin?
And there we are, back again, with the second part of our analysis of the production video number 8. We started that last week, and today we're going to finish what we began. We still have, I think about 7 or 8 minutes of that production video that we need to go through frame by frame. We uncovered the tomatoes on the table of Bilbo's house, which we're not supposed to be there, at least. I don't think that Tolkien wanted them to be on the table, as well as many other details. And also, what I think is most interesting are these glimpses of potentially movies 2 and 3. Joining me today for this analysis is, again, my co-host from Secrets of Middle Earth, Inga Lotz. Good day.
Hello.
People are listening to this morning, afternoon, evening, so I wanted to say good morning, but it's not even morning when we're recording this.
Oh, we are actually in the same time zone this week, so yeah.
Still, yes, because next week you are going to be in the United States for the Catholic New Media Conference. I will be joining you a week after that. And so we're going to be traveling all over the place. That's also what's happening to Dave, because, of course, the fans of this show are missing Dave. Where is Dave? Well, Dave is currently at a conference on one of the islands on the east side of the United States. I'm not exactly sure where, but I'm sure that he'll tell us next week. So the internet connections there are terrible, so he's unable to join us. But, you know, we had this planned last week that we would do a part two of the analysis. So actually, everything comes together. And next week, we'll talk about all the other news that is popping up. And there are some really interesting things happening in the world of The Hobbit, but you'll have to wait another week. But Inga, first of all, we got quite a bit of feedback on our first part of our analysis of production video 8, most of which was posted on our website, thehobbit.sqpn.com. That's also the place where you can find all the previous episodes if you're a new listener. Welcome, by the way. And so, Inga, what's the first piece of feedback that people gave on our analysis?
First piece of feedback is from Kendrell, and he writes, first of all, great production, love it. And then he writes, about the dwarves running in the beginning, I don't think this is the Battle of Five Armies, but part of a flashback of the Battle of Azanul Bazar, which is part of movie 1, I think.
Ah.
Look at the hair of Thorin Oakenshield, it's all black, no trace of grey, so he's very young, which would make perfect sense. So they are right, this is part of movie 1, but not part of the Battle of Five Armies, it's a flashback of the Battle of Azanul Bizarre, I think.
Wow, that is interesting. I don't know if you can deduct that from just the hair color of one of the...
Well, it makes sense because the Battle of Azanul Bizarre basically explains why dwarves and goblins are such bitter enemies, because that's where it started.
I know, but on the other hand, I wonder if the story needs it. I mean, they could talk about it, but do they really need to show us that? And if so, you know, why haven't we seen anything from the Battle of Five Armies? I'm a little bit...
Yeah, it's also, you need...
conflicted about
you,
this.
You need also, need to explain what's not Thror, but the other one, Trine, is doing in Dol Guldur.
Why Dol Guldur? Oh, as a backstory. how he ended up there.
Dol Guldur. How did he get there? And it has to do with, he was part of a company who wanted to, I think, either get the Lonely Mountain back, so he had a map, but he and a little bit of hazy on that. But there's also something that the dwarves wanted to retake Moria.
Yes.
And there were several attempts. So you have Tror, who walked in with a servant being a little bit wacky and thought, well, if I show up, they will give it back to me, which was not so much the case. Mm-hmm. And I think there are other tries also with Balin later on,
mm-hmm.
who tried to retake Moria. So in order to explain all those dwarves at unlikely places, I can see how they... would tie in the Battle of Azanulbizar, mm-hmm. because that basically brings that together.
And this could be one of the flashback could be part of that whole meeting at Dol Guldur, where at first there's a fight, and then, you know, Gandalf talks with Thrain, and he tells the story of what happened to him, something like that. Yeah. Although it's still, I was like, in the first movie, do we need all that? Is it not going to be too confusing for all of us? Although they have to paint a bigger picture right from the start, but
yeah, they did that also by the trilogy. They also started with the Battle of the Last Lion. I'm not sure what that was called, but when the ring was cut off Sauron's hand, Sauron was defeated, mm-hmm. he could never take his current form again, and that they put that in because you need to know where the ring comes from.
Well, of course, and the problem with Lord of the Rings was that they didn't tell the story of the Hobbit, and so you needed that introduction to know the context of the smaller story, at least the smaller way in which it begins. But with the Hobbit, I wonder if you need that right from the start. So if this is a flashback, I think it's going to be more in the second half of the movie than in the first half. Perhaps even all the way at the end, who knows? But again, I hadn't thought of that possibility that it might be part of the Battle of Azanulbizar. But I still think that there's also a possibility that it is the Battle of Five Armies.
There are other hints which point at the Battle of Azanulbizar being in the movie.
Really?
Because the altar you mentioned could also be a tomb in Moria, for example, and there's another flash of you see. We come into that later, where you see dwarves moving into something that looks like a lot like Moria.
Hmm.
So it could be.
Hmm.
So.
Hmm. Interesting. Two possibilities.
But
then,
of course, all the dwarven dwellings look similar, especially when there's a lot of green screen around it. So.
Dwarven fashion doesn't change that quickly. It takes a couple of centuries. Yeah. But great feedback, Kendrell. Now, Tony also posted a comment on our blog. Hey, guys, first, love the show, blah, blah, blah. I'll not read that. Happy that we're getting three movies, so the podcast will be going on for a bit longer as well. I'm happy about that, too. Speaking of food stuff, I think that Tolkien put some of that stuff in there as intentional anachronisms. For example, tomatoes, potatoes, and tobacco are all indigenous to the Americas, and tea is indigenous to India and Southeast Asia. As a medievalist, Tolkien would have known all of this. I think he puts that stuff in there to make the world of the Shire generally and Bag End specifically seem very familiar and homey. Both The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings are both told from a hobbit's eye view, so making their food familiar helps us, as modern big people, to identify with them. Yeah, that's interesting. What's your take on that, Inge?
Well, also I reacted on him. The thing is, if you look at the Shire, it's very UK or British.
Mm-hmm.
So the hobbits are very British people. So they eat very British food. And you have to remember that at the time this was written, the British the British Empire was a lot bigger than Great Britain right now.
Mm-hmm.
So tea was from India, but India was part of Great Britain at that time. And tobacco, there's a lot of Tolkien literature fans, how do you say that? People who are into the lore, they also point out that tobacco doesn't necessarily appear in the books. That's pipeweed, and pipeweed is not necessarily the same as tobacco.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, the potatoes are there, but if you have ever been in Great Britain, that's kind of the staple food right now.
Yeah, but
it's very, very hard to point, because Tolkien tries to give us a kind of medieval European feeling in the books, but you cannot say, well, the book plays in the 1500s of the European Middle Ages, because it's not a one-to-one comparison, but he tries to give that atmosphere.
But then that would make the case actually for the presence of tomatoes. I mean, if you put potatoes on the table,
yeah,
why
the
not
British
tomatoes?
A kitchen, I know, not really.
Nah, that's
a lot
not
of
true.
Tomatoes.
Of course, they have tomatoes. I mean, if you allow potatoes, then you should allow tomatoes, I think.
Yeah, but they are not featured in the books, so that's first. And
well,
if I think Shire, I think mushrooms, farmer maggot, carrots, onions, cabbage, that kind of stuff. That's very heavily used in British dishes, but mushrooms is more in southern European dishes, like Italian and southern French and Spanish dishes.
And so what if the dwarves took some food with them? And this is actually something that they brought with them?
It could be.
Why not? They've got the musical instruments and everything.
This, but I was like, oh, tomatoes. That's weird. I never read about tomatoes. So it was just a spur of the moment comment of me, like, why are there tomatoes on that table? Because that's not British. Yeah,
It's going to be interesting. It's of course kind of hair splitting stuff.
I had a long conversation with my kinmates on Lonely Mountain Band in Lothal as well with them, and they were like, "Yeah, it's lore breaking if you do tomatoes." And others were like, "No, they are not lore breaking." So,
are there tomatoes in Lord of the Rings Online?
No.
No. Okay. Well, that solves it then. All right, more feedback from Dedrick. Father Roderick, I don't know how you can be so dismissive of the possibility of the Battle of Azanulbazar being portrayed. You mentioned that you think it would be confusing, but I think having that battle near the beginning of the movie is exactly the same kind of technique that Peter Jackson used with the Battle of the Last Alliance in Fellowship of the Ring. In fact, opening with the frame of Bilbo would allow him to use a Galadriel-esque type narrative about the history of the dwarves and orcs' animosity. It always seems as if you come off as if you have some real knowledge of what will be actually in the film, whereas there is ample evidence from Peter Jackson's previous film work on this subject to prove that it is not confusing, but actually thematically appropriate. Not only that, in several other instances, you've actually pointed to things that Peter Jackson has done in previous films as evidence to support your theories on other points. If you have knowledge of the script of or what's actually been filmed, and please continue it if you don't, then perhaps backing away from having such a strong response to your co-host in this episode being Inge. Hey, well, that doesn't make for an interesting podcast if I don't have opinions.
I'm not easily offended, Dietrich. Don't worry.
And, you know, that's my personality, is I have opinions and I might be wrong, but I want you to be yelling at your podcast. And even more, I want you to be commenting on the website. I mean, what fun is it if we all agree, if no one has a divergent opinion? And no, I don't have any idea of what Peter Jackson will film or whatnot. But I'm just putting out my opinion about, like, if I were Peter Jackson, which I'm not, unfortunately, I wouldn't, you know, I would be careful to put the Battle of Azanulbazar in there because, you know, don't we have enough battles already, et cetera. So I don't think that I'm not going to back away. And I hope that my co-host won't either, and I sure know that Dave Gill, you know, he is opinionated. He has his ideas about what will it be in the movie. I mean, that makes for an interesting discussion. So, yeah, and if you don't agree, that's totally fine with me also. I mean, we're not talking theology here. We're talking about a fictional story and about a fictional movie that is based on a fictional story. So I don't see what's wrong with some healthy speculation and divergent opinions. But anyway, I assume that you don't agree with me, which is part of the fun, isn't it? We all try to figure out what's going to happen and what we'll see. And then when we're sitting in the theater watching movie one, then you can call me up and say, nah, 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 I was right.
That's why I want to watch it with you.
I will probably have forgotten all what I said. I usually don't remember my positions in these podcasts. I just love to speculate about things. And I've been wrong before. I mean, I had a whole website dedicated to the first Star Wars prequel. And I was, for years, I've been speculating and trying to piece together what would be in that, you know, in the Phantom Menace. And yeah, I was wrong on a lot of things, and I was right on a lot of things. I mean, that, but the fun is the journey, not the end result. So there you go. That's why I'm opinionated. It's part of my job here on the podcast. And well, that's about it for the comments on our previous episode. And so let's move on. When we stopped our recording, we were in Rivendell. And so let's pick up there and see what else is in this wonderful production video.
Hi, Comic-Con. It's Adam Brown here, a.k.a. Ori from The Hobbit set. One of the most exciting things, I think, for me was working on these sets that kind of are part of our history. And there was I working on Rivendell with some incredible actors.
Just watching Cate Blanchett act, it was very moving. We had shivers down our spines. It was absolutely astonishing.
So that's the famous or infamous scene between Gandalf and Galadriel, where we've seen this glimpse in the trailer where she's touching his hair and people are like, oh, is this a romance? We get a top-down view of her dress. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. And it's not the same dress she was wearing in the trilogy of The Lord of the Rings, I think. It's not a dress.
It's definitely another dress, and it's beautiful, although a bit impractical with all these stairs in Rivendell. I mean,
and not to mention all those trees in Lothlorien, but
yeah,
that's minor details.
Well, but here in Rivendell, she has to, you know, climb stairs all the time to get to that balcony, and then if you have that big dress, you might want to hire some elves to carry it behind you.
Yeah, maybe she has a complete court. And
yeah,
all kinds of assistance helping her move around.
But I love the contrast between the very kind of ethereal looks of Galadriel, timeless, and then, you know, Gandalf in this kind of gray robes and a very much more of a battered and bruised guy who, you know, has traveled the world. And I love that contrast between kind of this old gray guy and then this timeless eternal elf. And she doesn't seem to have changed a bit.
Now, isn't that amazing? How long has it been? 10 years?
Yeah. It's incredible. She looks exactly
the makeup
same.
Does a lot, of course.
I
but
guess so.
Still.
I guess so. But it's fantastic. I'm glad that they can do that. Now, there's this other scene where Peter Jackson is also giving directions, and Galadriel is holding hands with Gandalf. So he's got the staff in his right hand and she's holding his hand. And in the background, you see part of the set, and it's beautiful. These statues of elves, female elves, and it's very
It's kind of
detailed.
Kind of ivy grown over it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. And little orange markers for the special effects so that they can track this shot and paste in the background, of course, because there's a green screen in the background.
Mm-hmm.
So if they move the camera, then it's much easier later on to track the movement of the camera thanks to those orange dots.
They're kind of ugly if you look at them.
That's the magic of CGI. They can completely remove those markers. It's interesting.
Yeah, I can't wait to see how the end product looks like.
I think it's going to be awesome.
I know from the first movie, I've been reading the Lord of the Rings since I was like 8 or 9 or so. And then seeing it alive, basically on a big screen, I was like, wow. I was completely ecstatic when I came out of the first movie because of it was so exactly how I imagined it.
Yeah, I had no prior knowledge of the whole production. And so when I watched the first movie, I was completely blank. I had no expectations whatsoever. So I remember just being very confused because I'm like, it's been like 15 years since I read this book. And so this whole introduction, the whole mythical backstory was utterly confusing to me. But I loved it. I loved it. I think this one's going to be even better. Let's continue here.
It's been a privilege being back in Middle Earth.
Hey, Comic-Con. Hope you're having a good time. My name is Lee Pace. I play the Elven King, Thranduil, Some of the work that I really loved was with Terry Notary, who designs movement for the different races. And the way the elves move is very different than the way the dwarves move, obviously. It was really fun to get into that character and really move in a way that is not human.
Yeah. This is a very cool little scene where we hear about the choreography. And of course, most of the movement has to do with the fighting and the battles. And so we get a few glimpses of mostly dwarves in a type of battle formation, marching towards...
running upstairs.
You think this looks like Moria. I agree with you. This definitely looks like the entrance to some underground cave or something.
Yeah.
But it could also be the exit of a castle
or
a
fortress.
Could
be a ton of places. Could also be in the Iron Hills. It could even be the entrance to the Lonely Mountain.
So this could be Azanulbazar. So part of that flashback. Which kind of makes sense. If they show scenes from all of this, then and if the previous glimpse was from Azanulbazar, then this probably also is for that. So that would pinpoint it to the location of the Mines of Moria. If this is a glimpse of the Battle of Five Armies, then this could just be, you know, the heavily armed dwarves leaving the fortress, and you know they've got their mission, go fight, and that's what they do. And you do see a fight, very very brief, like 1 second fighting scene with some orcs in them, big orcs actually. They almost look like, gosh, what's the name again of these big creatures in Lord of the Rings? The
trolls?
No, not the trolls. The
Uruk-hai.
So they almost seem a bit too big to be orcs.
They cannot be at Uruk-hai.
No, that's what
they
thought.
They were created by Saruman.
Yeah.
They were not in existence, so it cannot be Uruk-hai.
Could they be pre-Uruk-hai?
No, because if you recall the story of the Lord of the Rings, at one point Saruman tears down all the trees in a vale around Isengard and creates those kind of like a factory under the ground, and there he breached those Uruk-hai.
Yeah,
and that's all taking place in the future.
But
so
even the Uruk-hai, weren't they an invention by Peter Jackson? I don't think that it's in the books, or is it?
No, Uruk-hai are in the books. They are troll-like, or they are a kind of breed that can tolerate daylight a lot better.
Ah, okay, yeah, because the other creatures don't. You're right.
Yeah, so like goblins who basically try to dwell in mountains because they don't like the sun.
Hmm. And Urko is from orc. I'm reading there's a whole Wikipedia entry on the Uruk-hai.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It's a kind of a cross between an orc and something else.
Yeah, they were of Sauron's breeding, but Saruman bred his own, making further changes, such as resistance to sunlight and more upright stature. So, hey, this could be the explanation. So what we see might not be Saruman's Uruk-hai, but we might see the original Uruks. So created by Sauron or by the Necromancer.
Yeah, it could be, but it can also be just large orcs. Yeah,
I'd love it if we could see the version one of the Uruk-hai. Who knows? I didn't know that little tidbit. Thank you, Wikipedia. Let's see. We were at the fighting scene. Oh, this is a great scene coming up next, with Sylvester McCoy.
Yes,
very comical character, and I think he's going to be awesome.
Sylvester McCoy, who played Radagast, is the loveliest, loveliest man.
I need people.
I think that Sylvester is
I'm laughing
be one
already.
The delights of these movies.
The real McCoy.
I remember going out to Trentham and wandering through the 100 meters of forest that they'd built and seeing Roscabel, which is Radagast's house.
Radagast's character was a lovely, spirited wizard, and his house really reflected his character beautifully.
Dale was beautiful.
That looked amazing. This is the first time that we see Sylvester McCoy in on the set, because we've seen little YouTube videos where he does the all comical, the recurring joke, whereas I'm going to tell you something about The Hobbit, and then he gets killed in many different ways because it's secret. Now we see him on the set. We see his house, Roscobel. So where is this house? Is this Mirkwood? Is this?
Yeah, it's in between the Carrick and the Old Forest Road. That's where the company enters the Mirkwood. So
it looks very much like his character. Even like the actor Sylvester McCoy, who is a little bit kind of ADD sometimes. So the house looks messy and lots of things.
Lots of herbs and all kinds of pots and or strange devices.
What I like is that some of the protrusions in his house kind of look like mushrooms that are now used to place things upon, and he's got a lot of dried mushrooms, and there is no normal window in his in his house, so all the windows are crooked. And on the table there is like a handmade cup, clearly something he made himself out of clay or something. And let's see if there's some more. There's this strange circular device. Did you get that? It looks kind of like something you'd use to predict the position of planets or something.
Yeah, and so it's kind of a scientific device. And if you look at the rest of his house, he doesn't come across to me as a scientific type. But
no, knows? but a very eclectic guy who is interested in anything. Because you can also see several glass vials on the table, almost as if he's doing like chemistry or alchemy or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a hobbyist. And then
most definitely. And stained glass in the windows. The whole house looks like it's made of bits and pieces he found somewhere.
Yes. Yeah. It looks a bit, if you're a fan of Harry Potter and you've seen the movies, it reminded me a lot of the cottage of what's the big guy? My brain is malfunctioning. The big guy with a beard in
Dumbledore?
No, the big guy, the giant.
I've never read anything of Harry Potter, so I can't help you.
I'm not sure. Should we cut this out? I thought Lynn was in the chat room. She knows. Oh, I can't believe it's my brain just switches to another realm.
The other one without a nose?
I completely forget. No, just the gently giant in Harry Potter. Everybody's yelling at his iPod now. Half giant. I need to Google everything nowadays. Hagrid. Good grief. Hagrid. So Hagrid's home looks a lot like what we see here. Although Hagrid's home is a little bit more, smaller. Now that I made a fool out of myself in front of all the Harry Potter fans, let's quickly move on.
Middle Earth, so it doesn't matter, right?
Gredigar's character was a lovely, spirited wizard, and his house really reflected his character beautifully.
Now, at the end of this scene, you see an outdoor set.
Yeah.
And I don't think this is part of Radagast's home. This looks to me like part of the Dale set.
Yeah, it is.
Because
it goes into a section about Dale. So at one point,
that's it.
The actor is walking around and he's just in his civvies in Dale. So I don't know if that's because the sets are close to each other. Because Radagast is not never in Dale, so.
Well, the Radagast's home is an indoor set, and I guess he's just walking around on the Weta workshop.
I think
premises.
So. Yeah. So that makes it a little bit confusing.
But it's cool to see another glimpse of Dale, and it's again it looks very Italian to me. Lots of food in this scene. There is this what is this? It looks like oh gosh, I'm trying to freeze frame it, but this is always a little bit tricky in these movies. There is a what's the word for that? Just a two wheel thing, container, something that's used by a merchant.
A cart?
Yeah, a cart. There's a cart filled with what looks like donuts and cakes.
Yeah, and cheese.
And there's cheese in the background, so yeah, it's...
I'm getting hungry looking at it.
There's an amphora in the background, for wine. There are onions hanging from the ceiling. This is...
garlic. It's very, very Tuscan, very...
Very Tuscan, yes.
Yeah.
So let's see what else they show us from Dale.
Dale was beautiful. It really was like, it was like being in another country.
It was very Moroccan, Turkish, sort of Italian. Yeah.
Dale was one of the larger sets.
It rivals some of the bigger sets we've ever built, which would have been Minas Tirith and Helm's Deep, I guess, in the old days.
The city of Dale was such a huge set. You're able to just wander around as if you were in some abandoned city you've always wanted to visit.
The most fun I've had on set would probably be the goblins.
So that's about the goblins, but we see a lot of Dale. Looks fantastic.
Yeah, and also untouched. So you must be right that the destruction of Dale must be in the first movie.
Oh yeah, I'm going to be very opinionated about this. I apologize to those of you that don't like that, but yeah, we're going to see Dale in the first movie. I have no inside knowledge, but I'm pretty sure. And I think it's what intrigues me and what I still can't figure out is how are they going to show us Dale? What's the story? I mean, you can't just give us 5 minutes of impressions like, and now for something totally different. Here is Dale. Look how beautiful it is. Isn't it nice?
This is sponsored by the Dale Tourist Board or something like that. Yeah.
And now back to The Hobbit. And, you know.
No, but I think that Bart the Bowman, is originally from Dale.
Yeah,
he
that
also
must be
later
it.
Becomes king or ruler of Dale, and his son actually dies protecting... Mm-hmm. How is he called? The dwarf? That's Thorin's son.
Some dwarf.
Yeah.
But
it's warm here. I'm fuzzy on names.
I can understand that you could tie the Bart the Bowman to Dale, but still, I'm looking for a logical bridge with what happens to Bilbo and the dwarves and the backstory. So what is going to be the link between Bart the Bowman and Dale? There has to be some narrative connection, and I can't figure it out.
Maybe his family was the ruling family of Dale, but it was destroyed, and they had to flee to Lake Town. And of course, it has been destroyed by Smaug. And so he, when the company arrives, he may have these visions of the destruction again, because those dwarves are coming to disturb the dragon again, and next time he may go after Lake Town, so something like that.
So in that case, if that is true, then we would see Dale only in a flashback, and it would also mean that the first movie would go on after the barrel scene, and we would get extensive scenes in Lake Town itself. I personally think it's, again, I'm going to voice an opinion here, so. Fast forward for 5 minutes if you don't want to hear what I have to say. But no, just kidding. That doesn't make sense to me from a storytelling perspective that you would first show Lake Town, which is completely new to us. We haven't seen Lake Town before. You get that exciting barrel ride in the river. And then the moment, and this is towards the end of the movie, the moment they arrive in Lake Town, they're going to show us Dale, and there's going to be this flashback to yet another place. I think it's
also
a little bit too much at the end of the movie.
Could also be that some of the dwarves in the company who are going to reconquer the Lonely Mountain were there when they had to fled the Lonely Mountain in the first place when the dragon arrived.
Could be. Yeah, so it could be one of the stories that the dwarves tell Bilbo.
Yeah, so I can also see that at one point you have to explain to the audience what's this Lonely Mountain, and why do the dwarves want to go back? So you have to explain that they were there in the first place, and they were chased away by Smaug.
And then,
of course, Dale would be still like in full glory, and maybe they traded with the dwarves, something like that. So they would show it in a pre Smaug era of the Lonely Mountain, how life was in Lonely Mountain before the dragon arrived. Then the dragon, the Smaug comes and destroys Dale. And then later on, some of the dwarves return, and then they meet Bart. Mm-hmm. And maybe they recognize him, or they I don't know, something like that.
Hmm.
But there are some dwarves in the company who are originally from the Lonely Mountain. But they were scattered around.
Who knows? Who knows? This could be part of a flashback, and then it's a big set, so you can count on it that it is used extensively. They're not going to build a big set like that.
They invest all the money in it.
Well, that's why I think it. You know, if they compare it with Helm's Deep, Helm's Deep was huge in the second movie, and a lot of the story took place there. So, what we do know for sure is that if Dale is used extensively, like pre-destruction Dale, then it has to be part stuff that Peter Jackson made up. And it might be in the spirit of the original story, but it is, I don't remember, you know, any Tolkien material about, you know, that is linked to the story of The Hobbit. But I might be missing something. I'm curious to hear our listeners' take on this. So if you have a theory about how Dale can be integrated into the story, let us know. Just go to thehobbit.sqpn.com, and in one of our future episodes, we'll quote you if you have good input. So let's go to the Orcs and Goblin Town, because that's another cool little glimpse that we get to see here of Goblin Town.
Goblin Town, the sets just seem to be really sharp and really angular and lots of flames and lots of bones.
We were introduced to the Great Goblin.
Well, Barry Humphreys is something of an iconic legend in this part of the world, and I've seen two or three of his Dame Edna stage shows, and Barry and the Goblin King just seem to be a natural fit.
Yeah. You seen the pile of intestines?
Oh, no, but I'll go and check them out.
I don't know if anyone's home, but we'll soon see.
I found Beorn's house absolutely...
We're moving to another location again. So, Goblin Town, what did you think of Goblin Town?
I wonder what the skeletons are, because that's always what strikes me in when I play Lotro as well. There are this orcs and goblins living among skeletons and decomposed bodies. So maybe they are victims of the goblins, and it's very lots of fire.
Yeah.
It's very disorganized. So it's always very. I'm always intrigued if you have the most beautiful locations like Rivendell, that's very organized. And the bad guys living amongst chaos. So that's those two opposites are very well portrayed. So yeah, evil is always chaotic of in nature, and good is always how do you say that? Organized in nature.
Yeah, that's kind of the difference between the elves and the orcs.
Yes,
the pointy ears are the only thing they have in common. I guess the skeletons kind of just show us how vicious they are and relentless. And I guess they need a lot of fire because they live in cold areas. And most of the orcs, despite all the meat that they eat, are pretty slim. they don't look too, you know, as having too much protection from fat. The Uruk-hai might have, but not the orcs.
No, and orcs and goblins live inside under the ground for most of the time. So, they wouldn't get a lot of energy from sunlight or
nor light. So just, or light. You need a lot of fire. But I think it looks great. There's even like a pack of meat hanging from the ceiling in the very fraction of a second of that scene. And it reminds me a lot of the way in which the Goblin Town was depicted in Lord of the Rings Online. I was very surprised at first when I entered that area in the game, that I always imagined Goblin Town to be a town. I always imagined it like, oh, do these orcs live in houses? And they have a little town square and a market, an orc market.
No, that would be way too organized. Yeah, so
but
no, it's
just a bunch of caves and lots of fire and lava and whatnot.
Yeah.
And this looked very similar to it, with lots of wooden ramps and,
And at one point you see Bilbo crawling, so then... they are trying to get away from the goblins after Gandalf came in.
Yeah.
And he created a huge flash of being like fireworks being detonated. So there was mass confusion.
Yeah.
And then the dwarves and Bilbo scrambled away. And that's where he finds the ring on the floor. And then puts it on and doesn't realize he's invisible.
Right. And that's how the dwarves lose track of him.
Yeah.
So, and he does carry his nice red coat in that scene with the
With the bronze buttons.
Yeah, so we do know exactly where to place this in the timeline. So let's move on. There's this big... with this first time we see Barry Humphries as the Great Goblin. Yes.
Did you ever watch those? I did.
It's something that's totally unfamiliar to our American audience, but this is pretty big, both in New Zealand. What is that? Oh, I've got... this is my phone, believe it or not. I got it on bird sounds. Someone started.
I was like, is Radagast entering the room?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. Is this a sound effect on my in my browser? No, it's my phone. Oh, well. This was pretty big in New Zealand and Australia and in parts of Europe where it was shown. We can tell that he's only doing the voice and his character is going to be completely CGI. So we can't really... We don't know exactly what it will look like.
We see at one point that he has a device on his head that tracks his facial movement. So I think they base the Goblin King like they base Gollum on Andy Serkis. So you would probably recognize something of him, but they will replace part of his face with CGI.
Yes, it's the entire face. It's the exact same technology that was used in Avatar, and all the characters in Avatar are, they're big blue aliens, but their faces are very expressive because they've been completely, even the little eye movements have been tracked by cameras. And so it's a huge step upwards from the type of animation that they had to do for Lord of the Rings, where all that technology wasn't there yet. And so a lot of what we see in Gollum is still hand animated, whereas now they will be using a lot more.
I'm so interested to see the new Gollum versus the old one.
I think it's going to be exactly identical.
Yeah, but from the old Gollum, so in Lord of the Rings, he always felt fake to me. He was never
really
there.
Oh, I thought it was pretty realistic. Yeah, I thought he was actually sometimes more realistic than some of the people in suits. And I think in terms of the quality of the CGI, definitely much more realistic, probably. But also, I think that his mannerisms and the way he's animated and his movements will be identical. They will probably tweak that so that it doesn't, create a disconnect. Like, oh, this Gollum is very different from the Gollum that
this is Gollum 2.0.
Yeah. And he's not supposed to because he's a younger Gollum. So, and from there we go to Beorn's house. Huge, because it's built on dwarven scale. Let's listen.
Absolutely mesmerizing. It's one of my favorite parts of the book, and the creation, the carving that they did inside that beautiful barn, and everything was so oversized.
I want to write the theme tune, sing the theme tune.
We built it to the scale of the dwarves, so it was huge. And it made all of us feel small. I used to be able to stand on that set and look at the crew sitting up the camera, and they looked like tiny little people. It was kind of incredible.
Morning, everyone.
It's amazing. Even the knife that one of the guys is holding at the end, it's huge. It's very funny because you see the entire crew. You see Peter Jackson walking around there. He looks like a dwarf.
It's like they went to Wonderland and ate all eight mushrooms.
Yeah, it's cool. I remember that in the Netherlands, where both of us live, there used to be this theme park about storybooks. And there was this one part of the theme park that was scaled up, and it was huge, including a big table and big chairs, and so you could go there with your kids, and the entire family would look tiny.
You can also go there without your kids. So.
Oh, you've been there?
Yeah, Land van Ooit.
Yeah, that's what I
meant.
It's unfortunately it's closed down because it didn't survive.
I'm still a big kid, so I always feel kind of minorly offended when people say, "Oh, that's where you bring your kids." And I'm like, I like it too.
Yeah, I know. That's I'm like that as well. But I can still have a blast in Disney World, even though it's supposed to be for kids. But those are parts of me that will probably never grow up. At least I hope not. So we go to the second unit's last day. This is second unit, of course, is all the stuff that is not done with the core crew, but with extras. And we see someone walking around in a barrel.
Morning.
And it's Andy Serkis.
How did he get in it?
Somebody stuck something to my back. What is it?
Second unit, I think we're a bit of the rock and roll unit, and, you know, we have a bit of fun.
While they're having fun, we're seeing a lot of interesting stuff there in the background.
Yeah, did you notice the t-shirts?
The t-shirts. I see one. A noise flying
and
circus?
Andy's flying circus.
Oh, Andy's flying circus. Oh, that's too funny.
But I saw a dwarf sitting on what looks like an eagle, on the back of an eagle.
Yes, I was wondering about that because it's a green screen set that he walks into. And then we see two animals, actually.
Yeah.
One has two dwarfs actually sitting on it. One is climbing on the back of it. Still can't identify the dwarfs. Part of the skeleton on which they're sitting is covered in green cushions. And then you see the head that definitely has the shape, it's a metal head of a bird or a dragon. But of course, this can be a dragon. It has to be one of the eagles. So it's the first glimpse that we get of the eagles.
Yeah, now I'm very opinionated again.
No, you can't. Sorry, I'm sorry. I can't be... No opinions. Just the scripture.
No, but as far as I can recall, the dwarves were picked up and hung at the talons of the eagle. They were not sitting on top of the eagle.
Ah, that's a minor detail, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's...
Perhaps they fell off, and then the eagle grabs them with his claws.
Yeah, but
claws.
Maybe I'm wrong as well, but it's like, oh, what's doing he on top of it?
But we've seen eagles before. I mean, we've seen the escape from Sauron's tower, where Gandalf also jumps on one of those eagles. So in a way, I think we already know what they look like.
Yeah.
But this eagle looks a bit smaller compared to, you know, if you look at the...
When those who rescued Gandalf and later also the company picked up Frodo from Mount Doom, when those Gwahir and Landrofel, the great eagles,
mm-hmm.
and maybe these are different.
Ah, oh, could be
ones.
Could be
just random big eagles. I don't know.
And of course, the eagles are going to play a role at the end of the story as well in the third movie during the Battle of Five Armies.
Yeah.
So, but it's nice. I was surprised that they showed us this glimpse. Because again, is this something that we will see in the first movie?
Yeah, well, that of course, if you see Goblin Town in the first movie, you see also eagles because they have to escape the burning forest. Which,
you're right.
Gandalf.
Yeah. So we will see this. We will see this. And we've seen in other production videos scenes where, too, it's green screen and you see these dwarves climbing in pine trees. And they're swinging back and forth in order to get from one tree to another. If that is part of the big fire, then this scene could follow straight after that, where you know, basically the eagles pick them up.
Makes sense why the warg, that's the other animal you see with a crew member on it.
Yes, yeah. There's a bit of a furry.
Yeah, it must be a warg.
Backside of.
I think we're a bit of the rock and roll unit, and you know, we have a bit of fun.
Yeah, it's definitely a warg. Very light hair, though. I always thought that these creatures would be a lot kind of darker.
Well, I think in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, they also had the same color of fur.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. So this is just probably just the head of this animal. And
yeah, or the back that someone sits on it.
And this could be mounted on one of those mechanical... bulls, you know, that you sometimes see. I mean, they need to have like a device underneath it that can make it move around in a lifelike way. So it's probably some mechanical bull type of, or at least a Middle Earth version of that. Must be a lot of fun to ride that thing to test it. And again, lots of markers in the background, which again indicates that during the filming of these wargs, the camera will be moving around. Probably, you know, if they want to zoom in or even have an animal run past the camera, instead of moving the animal, you might as well move the camera That's an old trick. Whenever you see spaceships, you know, like pre-CGI spaceships in science fiction movies, you think that the Starship Enterprise is moving towards you. Actually, what you're looking at is the camera moving towards the model. And then it's just a matter of replacing the background, and it will seem as if the ship is moving, but it's all the camera does all the movements. And of course, this seems to me like a very big prop. It's probably just going to move up and down, but it's not going to move forward. It doesn't have legs. So that's probably why they have the markers in the background, so they can kind of take that into account when they do the background animation, and it will actually seem as if these wargs are running at high speed in our direction.
Greg's shorts, I think.
Yeah. Just loop it, bro. Just loop it. No problem.
I'm disturbed.
It's like an 8-year-old schoolboy.
What do you mean it's like an 8-year-old schoolboy?
And there's some weird music with Andy Serkis playing
saxophone.
I didn't know that either. Hey, that was Legolas in the background. Did you see him?
Yes, he will see more of him.
Yeah.
Upcoming.
So, you also noticed one or two frames with someone in a rubber boat, in floating in a pond.
Yeah, that looked like the Dale set to me because I saw an Italian style gondola in the back. Oh. So it's kind of the party. So they are kind of floating around on the set and just making fun of themselves.
But would this be, I mean, Dale, does Dale have water? It does make sense if it looks like Venice, then.
Yeah, sure. It looks Italian, and I cannot think of anything else what it could be with the
Lake
Town? Background. Or Lake Town, yeah. It could also be background gondola. I see some kind of,
let me freeze frame. I see a boat, indeed. I do see a bit of wood in the background. The guy has a funny hat. Let's see. It's just too short.
I did many tries to capture that one. Yeah.
Yeah, you only see a tiny fragment of the background.
We're going to the Rock and Roll unit, and you know we have a bit of fun.
Let me try again. This is the Eagle. There you go. So you see a boat on the right side. It doesn't look too Venetian to me. This could be Lake Town as well.
Yeah, could be.
Didn't they say in one of the other videos that Lake Town also had a water set, like water?
Yeah, if it's near a lake, it has to have water.
Yeah, but I mean this is an indoor set because there's green screen, and I know that the Dale set was built outside.
Yeah, could also be Lake Town.
Yeah, my guess it's Lake Town because Dale is built on a hill and it's out in the open.
The reason I thought Dale was like, it had this Italian vibe to me. So yeah. I immediately thought Dale and Lake Town itself is more like Nordic.
Yeah, but the boat doesn't really strike me as too Italian. This could be just a regular Lake Town boat.
Yeah, could be.
Of course, I know that because I know everything about this first movie. I'm saying Lake Town.
Okay. Yeah, then it's Lake Town if you say so.
But feel free to disagree with me.
Yeah.
Just don't yell at me.
I'll do that after we close the microphone and.
Let's move on to, what is it? Okay, we got the saxophones, and now we get Legolas.
He's a rock star.
There he is.
He has got energy to burn, and that infectious enthusiasm.
What was that big shoe?
Made a huge difference.
Did you see that?
Just continue.
Okay, there's a big, big shoe. Looks like a giant.
Runs to the second unit.
And crank it up. And it's 3, 2, 1, action! And cut! That is a wrap for the second unit.
That looked pretty cool. The fighting scene with Legolas.
Great dialogue also.
Yes, yeah. You can tell that he's a professional actor. I think they already yelled cut before he did the Tarzan thing. But what was that big shoe?
I think it belongs to the dwarf.
Oh,
in the next shot.
Because it's so close up, it looks like an enormous statue.
Yeah, but of course
the
actor is normal sized in this, and then they will make a huge set in a green screen.
Ah, let me see again.
He has got it.
So it's a 7:34.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It's actually the perspective is a little bit. The foot must be really close to the camera.
I've no idea who that dwarf is, by the way. So.
It's a huge foot. I think this foot is bigger than a human foot, but perhaps
infectious
not.
Enthusiasm and his absolute dedication.
And these dwarves are different dwarves as well. These are not the dwarves from Bilbo's company.
No. Who are they?
Well, again, this could be Azanulbazar, but I don't think they're going to show that in a movie. So this could be the Battle of Five Armies. Who knows? Anyway.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Right. We've already started playing the background music.
We made progress. We're now halfway through.
This is terrible. How much do we have left?
7 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, but well, I'm looking at your notes. There's not much left. So
no,
I might as well wrap it up.
Less reminiscing.
So there is the cosmetics department, and there is a blurred out photo in the background. Do you have a theory who that might be?
I think those are kind of orcs or goblins or maybe Beorn. So something we haven't seen.
I was thinking the necromancer, actually.
Could also be, yeah.
There's this one scene with and it's just a weird, it looks like a skull or something. It looks very weird and scary, and there are two photos that are kind of skull-like, and one is like orange, and I don't know, I'm thinking that's the only character that we really don't want to see, of course, now, because the necromancer is the big thing of the second movie. So
yeah.
I don't know. Then we see a dwarf hanging at the talons of a great eagle at the 9 minutes 23 mark.
Yeah, that would be the work scene again with the forest on fire, I think.
Yeah. Now we also have again the Mirkwood wine cellar set at 10 minutes 2 seconds.
Yeah, but we already discussed that.
We
most
did
of that.
That at 10 minutes 26 seconds. You've got Bilbo in Gollum's cave. That too is something we've seen quite extensively.
Mm-hmm.
And then at 11:49, they show the last day of principal photography.
And then there's a weird creature in the final clips,
mm-hmm.
And he's blurred out as well. So I think that may be Beorn.
Oh, that could be, of course, because we've seen Beorn's house, but not the rest.
Yeah.
Interesting. And all sorts of beautiful glimpses of Rivendell, the Rivendell set, and some of the Mirkwood sets. Just great stuff to go frame by frame through, but not much story, extra story stuff
so
that we haven't talked about yet.
There's not much new stuff in it, except for the part where Beorn is blurred out. Because there's the last day, and then there's a speech from Peter Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And then the camera pans around, and it's someone in the audience is blurred out, so... So I think it's someone who was in the last scene. They missed this shot.
Yeah. There's also a great photo of the dwarves in a barrel. And you know there's this one dwarf that has an axe in his head?
Yeah.
And he apparently caught a fish with it because there's a fish stuck on it. And looks brilliant. And in the background, very interestingly, I think it is Lake Town. And I don't think that's Mirkwood. So we will probably see them arrive in Lake Town. And actually, one of the other dwarves also has a rubber fish in his hands. And then, of course, we see some more glimpses of Gandalf, battered and bruised, needs a horse. So it's probably after he got attacked at Dol Guldur. Lots of other...
he discovered something and he needs to report on it, so he needs to go away very quickly.
Yeah. So anyway, that's it for our analysis, two-part analysis of... the production video, if you want to see the first, listen to the first part, go back to thehobbit.sqpn.com. Thanks for your feedback. Looking forward to getting your comments on this analysis, and we'll be back soon with another episode of The Secrets of The Hobbit. Thank you, Inge, and thank you for listening.
SQPN, leading the way in Catholic new media.